House Transportation Committee. Our first bill is a public hearing and possible work session on 2107. John, want to give us an idea of what this bill does?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is a rather lengthy bill that is in many ways a kind of bill that's designed to reconcile Oregon law to various changes that have been made in federal transportation regulations and also some of the provisions of the Patriot Act as it affects the transport of hazardous waste. We're going to be receiving a rather detailed explanation of the contents of the bill today. It basically deals with five different subject areas. One is school bus endorsements or the ability of an individual to drive a school bus. The second is disqualification from holding a commercial driver's license under certain circumstances. The third deals with various changes related to suspension of commercial driver's licenses. The fourth deals with driving while under the influence of intoxicants by a person holding a commercial driver's license. And the fifth area, generally speaking, deals with the hazardous waste material driving endorsement. One thing you need to be aware of, and that is that the federal government, through its various regulations and statutes that are addressed in this legislation, is requiring Oregon to be in compliance with those laws and regulations by no later than September 5th of this year. And the hammer that they have is that if we fail to do so, there would be a 5% reduction in the amount of highway funds that we receive for the initial year of noncompliance, and then 10% in the following years if we're still not in compliance.
Okay. Thanks, John. Robin and Tom, you want to come up? Start working our way through this one.
Good afternoon, Chair Gilman, members of the committee. My name is Robin Freeman. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Department of Transportation. And with me, I have Tom McClellan. Tom's the manager of DMV Program Services. And Tom will be walking you through a section-by-section review of this bill. House Bill 2107, with the proposed Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, brings Oregon into compliance with the Motor Carrier Safety Improvement Act of 1999 and the USA Patriot Act of 2001. These federal laws establish new requirements and standards for people who operate commercial motor vehicles. This bill establishes a new license endorsement to operate school buses, new standards for commercial driver's licensees that apply when they are operating their personal vehicles, a new commercial driver's license suspension for persons operating a commercial motor vehicle while their license is suspended, authority to suspend a person's commercial driver's license if the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration notifies DMV that a driver is disqualified from operating a commercial motor vehicle because they've determined the individual to be an imminent hazard, new serious traffic violations that may result in suspension of a commercial driver's license, provisions that prohibit a court from deferring or masking driver violations on a person's driving record when the person has a commercial driver's license or was operating a commercial motor vehicle at the time of the violation, and DMV rule authority to implement security background checks on people who apply for or have a hazardous materials endorsement. DMV implemented the original Federal Commercial Motor Carrier Act of 1986 in April of 1990. The Motor Carrier Safety Improvement Act of 1999 was enacted to reduce the number and severity of truck crashes through increased inspections and compliance reviews, stronger enforcement measures, and improvements to the commercial driver's license program. Federal regulations stipulate that if a state is not in substantial compliance with each requirement, the state will be decertified and must discontinue their commercial driver's license program. Federal regulation would then require Oregon drivers to go to another state to obtain a commercial driver license. In addition, The Secretary of Transportation may withhold Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program funds and federal aid highway funds. In your packet today, I believe the last page is a letter to the governor from the Motor Carrier Safety Administration, and it addresses these impacts in detail. In my testimony today, there's a section that says components of House Bill 2107. I'm not going to cover that right now orally because Mr. McClellan will be walking you through the section-by-section review. He'll cover each of these components in much more detail than my testimony would today. So I would move to the end of page two for my written testimony under issues to consider. Oregon's failure to comply with the Motor Carrier Safety Improvement Act of 1999 and the USA Patriot Act of 2001 jeopardizes full allocation of the federal aid highway funds and Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program grant funds for Oregon. The state would lose approximately $2.7 million annually in Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program funds, of which $1.6 million is allocated to the Oregon State Police. In addition, 5% of the annual federal aid highway funds would be withheld the first year Oregon was not in compliance, and this equals $12 million, and 10% each year following, which equals $25.2 million. Non-compliance would also result in federal decertification of the Oregon Commercial Driver's License Program. In summary, enacting House Bill 2107 is necessary to maintain Oregon's compliance with federal laws, and it eliminates the risk of losing the federal funding. Thank you for considering our recommendations to revise these statutes. And at this time, I'm going to ask Mr. McClellan to walk you through this section-by-section review of the bill and answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I am the manager of program services at DMV. I've been asked to go through a little more detailed review of the bill. It's a 31-page bill with lots of information in it. And as your committee staff informed you, there are five main sections of the bill. I won't go back through those, but to keep that in mind as we go through that, it'll give you some sense of reference, I guess, as we talk about the various provisions of the bill. Sections 1 through 11 bring Oregon into compliance with federal regulations by establishing a school bus driver license endorsement. A passenger endorsement is no longer sufficient for operating a school bus. Effective October 1st of 2005, persons operating school buses must have a school bus endorsement. Specific provisions, it allows a tow vehicle operator to continue to tow disabled school buses without a school bus endorsement. It requires that the driving demonstration for a passenger endorsement be performed in a vehicle designed to transport 16 or more people. It requires that the driving demonstration for a school bus endorsement be performed in a school bus, specifically a school bus. Adds authority for the department to accept a certificate of competency issued by an approved third-party tester in lieu of a DMV drive test. The Oregon Department of Education is an approved third-party tester. It establishes a $21 issuance fee for a school bus endorsement to a person who already has a commercial driver license. It also stipulates that a new applicant who presents a certificate of competency from a third-party provider must also pay the $40 fee listed in subsection 8 of the driver fee statute for a total of $61. In addition, it adds a $10 fee for the school bus endorsement knowledge test, which is equal to the amount charged for other knowledge test endorsements that we administer today. Today we have approximately 6,500 bus drivers. If we can get this passed in time, we can move these 6,500 drivers through a knowledge test, a paper test, without the need for a behind-the-wheel test, because those requirements change September 30th of this year. So that is our goal, is to try to work with the school districts and get those bus drivers through as quickly as possible so they can avoid that behind-the-wheel test in a school bus.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question. Why would you want to avoid the behind-the-wheel test on a school bus?
Most of them have already gone through that kind of testing through the Department of Education. That's what that certificate of completion that's been issued by the Department of Education provides. It may not be accepted, what we've done in the past, without that after September 30th. Because the new requirements kick into place there. So we would like to grandfather them in with the testing that's already been done on those drivers.
Further question?
Yeah.
How does the Department of Ed test differ from the DMV test?
It's not significantly different. In fact, in some ways, it may be more stringent. They're telling us it is more stringent, but we check what they do and verify that it is a complete test behind the wheel.
Thank you.
Did I understand you correctly to say then that if somebody is already driving a bus and has all the appropriate endorsements and everything, they don't have to go through the whole test?
They don't have to get behind the wheel and do that test. There is a knowledge test that we are working on with the Department of Education that they would still have to take.
It was my impression that the discretion afforded the state under the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Rules goes away after September 30th.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, it still is in effect. It still requires that type of knowledge test and a behind-the-wheel test after September 30th for a school bus endorsement. I don't understand your question.
Well, I guess I'm not understanding you. I thought I heard you say that that you can grandfather people in. If they've been driving a bus, they don't have to take the behind-the-wheel test. That's what 2107 allows for.
That's by our implementation of the bill, actually.
And that's consistent with the new Federal Motor Carrier Rules?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, we believe it is.
Okay.
Further questions?
Okay. The next part of the bill deals with disqualification from holding a commercial driver's license. Sections 12 through 19 suspend a person's commercial driver license for conviction or implied consent action listed in Section 13, sub 2, in any motor vehicle. This is required also by federal regulations. The only exception is the blood alcohol level of 0.04, which must occur in a commercial motor vehicle. It's not in a passenger vehicle. So it's a more stringent standard for driving a commercial motor vehicle. It also gives authority to suspend a person's right to apply for a CDL when they receive one of the convictions while operating a commercial motor vehicle. The significant change is that persons with a CDL will be suspended when these offenses occur in their personal vehicle. Today, when a person receives two or more of these convictions from separate incidences, the department suspends the person's CDL for a right to apply for a CDL for a lifetime only if the offense occurred in a commercial motor vehicle. The offenses include driving under the influence of intoxicants, refusing the breath test, failure to perform the duties of a driver, any conviction of a crime punishable as a felony, a conviction for driving a commercial motor vehicle while suspended, and a conviction for any degree of murder, manslaughter, or criminally negligent homicide or assault in the first degree while operating a commercial motor vehicle. Currently, a license with a lifetime suspension cannot be reinstated. The proposed changes allow persons to apply for reinstatement 10 years after the lifetime suspension is imposed. The person must voluntarily enter and complete a rehabilitation program that's been approved by the department. However, if the person receives another conviction or an implied consent action after getting a license reinstated, the person's CDL is suspended for life and they can never get it back. The exception to this process is a CDL holder with one conviction for a felony involving the manufacture, distribution, or dispensing of a controlled substance involving any type of motor vehicle. This person receives a lifetime CDL suspension and cannot apply to get it back after 10 years. Specific provisions from Section 13. A person's CDL or right to apply for a CDL will be suspended if they receive any combination of two or more of the listed convictions or implied consent actions in any motor vehicle. Subsection 3. A CDL holder receiving one felony conviction involving the manufacture, distribution, or dispensing of a controlled substance involving any motor vehicle will receive a lifetime CDL suspension and they cannot apply to get it back early under Subsection 4. In subsection 4, the person can apply to reinstate their CDL suspension 10 years after the second conviction or implied consent action. DMV can reinstate the person's CDL if the person has completed a rehabilitation program that's been approved by the department and any of the requirements that are stipulated in administrative rule. Subsection 5, if the person gets their license reinstated after the 10 years applicant gets another conviction or implied consent action, their CDL is suspended for life and they cannot get it back after another 10 years. In subsection 6, a conviction or implied consent action must be from separate incidences, and persons who do not hold a CDL must have been driving a commercial motor vehicle. Section 14 defines how the offenses will be applied. Offenses that are committed before the effective date will count toward a lifetime suspension only if committed in a commercial motor vehicle. The offenses committed in any motor vehicle will begin counting toward the lifetime suspension on or after the effective date of the bill.
Yes. Am I understanding you correctly that if a person has one conviction or implied consent action today, they got a second one after the effect date of the bill, that would not qualify? The first one is basically starts off as though everybody's record is completely clean?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, no, it's not starting completely clean. It's just the new provisions with the driving in your own personal car that take effect after the effective date of the bill.
If I can follow up. Sure. So that, related to the effective date of the bill, that does not apply to all those previous subsections you talked about. That's just related to that last point there?
And on. Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Further questions?
The next part of the bill deals with suspension of commercial driver licenses. Sections 20 through 24 propose changes to the CDL suspensions and serious violation suspensions to comply with federal regulations. ORS 809-413 is replaced with new language, although there are really few substantive changes in the bill. It's been reconstructed basically in the way Legislative Council has drafted that portion of the bill. The proposed changes created CDL suspensions for convictions in any motor vehicle for failure to perform the duties of a driver involved in an accident and crimes that are punishable as felonies, including the manufacture, distribution, and dispensing of a controlled substance. If the person does not have a CDL but is operating a commercial motor vehicle, convictions will result in a suspension of the person's right to apply for a CDL. Section 20 of the bill defines the length of time for CDL suspensions. Suspension lengths have not changed from current statutes. All the suspension actions are entitled to administrative review, except those that are arising from a notification from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, and those are dealing with an imminent hazard. Subsections 1, 2, and 3 add the provisions that convictions while operating any motor vehicle will result in the suspension of the CDL. Subsection 4, new CDL suspension for operating a commercial motor vehicle while suspended or revoked based on a CDL offense. And the length is from 1 year to a lifetime if the person has a prior suspension as identified in Section 13. Subsection 5, CDL suspension for operating a commercial motor vehicle and committing murder, manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, or assault in the first degree. This subsection adds the provision to suspend a person's right to apply if they commit one of these offenses while operating a commercial motor vehicle without a CDL. Subsections 6 and 7 define the suspension lengths for serious traffic violations and for violating out-of-service orders. There are no changes to the lengths of suspension. Amendment 2 to this bill will require suspensions for serious traffic violations to run consecutively. Subsection 8, immediate CDL suspension, not to exceed 1 year, based on notification from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration that the CDL holder is an imminent hazard. The CDL holder is entitled to a post-imposition hearing. Subsections 9 and 10, new CDL suspensions for failure to appear and failure to comply in other jurisdictions. These are imposed for the same reasons as those imposed in Oregon. Must have had a CDL or been operating a commercial motor vehicle. There is a 5-year statute of limitations, same as in Oregon. These are reciprocity-type provisions with other states. Subsections 11 and 12, the CDL suspension authority to allow suspensions in Oregon based on an out-of-state conviction or notice of action in the other state. Section 22, the Dash 1 amendments include definitions of a serious traffic violation. They add reckless driving in a non-commercial vehicle if the person holds a CDL. also adds operating a vehicle without driving privileges and failure to carry or present a license to police officers to the list of violations of operating a commercial motor vehicle. Sections 21 and 23 deal with when the provisions take effect. The department will apply current suspension authority when a driver with a commercial driver commits one of the offenses in a commercial motor vehicle. These offenses will continue to count toward the potential lifetime suspension. Again, on and after the effective date of the bill, the department will begin taking suspension action or count them toward the lifetime suspension when the offense occurs in their personal vehicle. New serious violation offenses must occur on or after the effective date of this bill. Are there any questions on that?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification. You mentioned that under Section 20, it says all of the suspension actions are entitled to an administrative hearing except those arising from notification by the FMCSA administrator relating to imminent hazard. Then I get down to subsection 8, and it says that a CDL holder is entitled to a post-imposition hearing. What's the difference between the administrative hearing for others and a post-imposition hearing?
Mr. Chair, committee staff, the administrative review is done by the department to review our process has been followed like it should have been followed. The post-imposition hearing is after that license has been suspended, has been taken away as a result of the Federal Motor Carrier Administration telling us that that person was an imminent hazard. So we act more quickly, immediately, to take that person's license away by suspending it. And then we'll have a hearing the department would held after the fact to ensure that we got the right person and that we got the notice. That's pretty much the extent of the post-imposition hearing, that the person is entitled to that type of review. Does that help?
Further questions? Okay.
The next part of the bill deals with driving while under the influence of intoxicants by persons that hold commercial driver licenses. Sections 25 through 29 identify the suspension lengths for CDL implied consent and CDL DUII suspensions. Again, Chapter 8, 13404 was amended completely so that those changes could be seen in their entirety. These sections include the provisions for persons who have a CDL and are operating a personal vehicle and those who do not have a commercial driver license but are operating commercial motor vehicles at the time of their offense. These sections also define when the provisions will take effect. And finally, they revise the notice that must be provided to the arrested person so that he or she can make an informed decision whether to submit to an implied consent test. Section 25 establishes the suspension lengths for the CDL implied consent and DUI suspensions. The suspension lengths are the same as current statute. This was just rewritten to refer to Section 13 of the bill. Section 26 says that the enhanced penalty provisions based on additional prior offenses committed in any motor vehicle apply only to those offenses committed on or after the effective date of the bill. Section 27 amends the implied consent statute to suspend a person's CDL if the person refuses an implied consent test and they were driving a commercial motor vehicle or any motor vehicle. This does not change language that the person must be driving a commercial vehicle to receive a CDL suspension for an implied consent test failure. Section 28 expands the rights and consequences language an arresting officer must use when informing the driver that he or she is being arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants. It provides that the notice include the new consequences if a person should refuse to submit to a breath test and the person has a commercial driver's license or is operating a commercial motor vehicle. The information must be provided to the arrested person so that he or she can make an informed decision whether or not to submit to an implied consent test. Section 29 changes the eligibility for diversion of DUII offenses. A person possessing a commercial driver license and anyone operating a commercial motor vehicle at the time of the offense is no longer eligible for diversion. Section 30 states that a court cannot defer entry of a judgment or allow an individual to enter into a diversion program that would prevent a conviction of a traffic offense from appearing on the driving record. This applies to all traffic offenses except parking violations, whether committed while driving a commercial motor vehicle or other types of motor vehicle. This includes a CDL holder while operating their personal vehicle. Are there any questions on that part of the bill?
I'd like to go back up to the version. The feds say absolutely that we cannot use a diversion when we have commercial driver's license. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is the way we read the regulations. They want everything on that record.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Finally, the last section deals with hazardous materials endorsements. Sections 31 through 37 give the department authority to implement the USA Patriot Act of 2001. This act requires persons who want to obtain or renew a hazardous materials endorsement to pass a security threat background check conducted by the Transportation Safety Administration. TSA and the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration have published federal regulations for that. The department has implemented these regulations under general rule authority provisions. A request more specific authority be placed in statute. The department will promulgate rules consistent with the federal regulations. Sections 31 and 32 define hazardous materials and establish the new hazardous materials endorsement provisions in the Oregon Vehicle Code. Section 33, the department cannot issue or renew a CDL with a hazardous material endorsement until the person submits to and passes a security background check. The department will cancel the hazardous materials endorsement if a person is determined to be a security threat by the Transportation Security Administration. Again, the person is entitled to an administrative review. It's a post-imposition review. Section 34 applies these provisions to the issuance or renewal of a hazardous materials endorsement on or after the effective date of the Act. In Sections 35 and 36, the holder of an instruction permit may not operate any motor vehicle that transports hazardous materials. A note here, Amendment 1 deletes the $50 hazardous materials endorsement security check fee that is in the original bill. The applicant will pay a TSA contractor to conduct those security checks. Those will not be conducted by the department, so they'll be more available across the state. I believe the current fee is about $94 through that third-party company. Miscellaneous provisions of the bill. Sections 38 and 39 define the effective date of the various sections of the bill. Provides authority to begin implementing the school bus endorsement upon passage. This is needed to assist current school bus drivers in applying for the new endorsement. Effective October 1, no one can operate a school bus without this endorsement. Provides emergency authority to implement the hazardous materials endorsement requirements. And the operative date of September 30, 2005 to implement the new commercial driver license offenses and sanctions as defined by the Federal Motor Carrier Regulations.
Question? Yes, John?
I was trying to pass this to you, but I didn't have time. What are the renewal procedures for the hazmat endorsement? Is it something that occurs annually or biennially or...
Mr. Chair, staff, I believe it's every 4 years. It's required in federal regulation every five to have the renewal. I think we're going to do it every four. I'll have to get back to you on that one for sure.
Yes.
A few questions. First of all, let's go back to Section 14. I'm still not quite clear on this. In the dash one... The Dash 1 amendment struck the original and put in two subparts. The first one says that offenses committed before, on, or after the effective date of this act, if the person was driving a CMV at the time of the offense. Okay, so if you have a DUI and a CMV 2 years ago, that would still count.
Mm-hmm.
But then subpart 2 says the offense is committed on or after the effective date if the offense is not as described in subsection 1, which would tell me that it's in a non-CMV. Interpretation correct? In other words, if you have a DUI 2 years old in a non-CMV, it's not going to count against you under this new
Yes, that's
procedure.
True.
Mm-hmm. Then it goes on to say, or if the offense is the offense described in Section 13.2F, which was also replaced. Oh, that stayed the same?
Mm-hmm.
And 13.2F deals with a conviction driving a CMV. So I guess it seems a little contradictory to me that if in subpart 1 we say if it's a CMV, then it applies, but then we accept that under part 2 if it falls under 13.2F. It doesn't, I guess it seems a little contradictory to me. Am I making any sense?
I understand, excuse me, Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, I understand your confusion. I actually had the same confusion, and they did explain this to me. And what they're actually referring to is prior to the date that the Act goes into effect, the bill goes into effect, or excuse me, the Act goes into effect September 30, 2005. If you're in your personal, what I'll call your car, and you get a DUI or other Section 13 offenses that are listed, that those do not count towards your commercial driver's license, the tick, so to speak, towards a lifetime suspension. But if after the date of the Act you are in your personal car, they would count. And I don't think I can answer your question on subsection 2 at this time, but let me get back to you on that and find out. I understand your question, but I'm not able to answer that.
In the dash 1, it's that last part of subpart 2, section 14, where it says, or if the offense is the offense described in section 13.2F of this Act. And that's when I'm curious, since 2F is all CMV related, why, you know, why is that? It just doesn't seem consistent with subpart 1.
We'll check on it.
Representative Hunt.
I guess my question, it starts at the same point, but it goes broader. I guess I'm not understanding why we would be exempting out any prior convictions, any prior violations of this whole, of all these instances in Section 13. I understand if it applies to CMV, you're saying they count, but if it applies, and reading through these in Section 2, 2A, 2B, 2D, 2E, 3, 4, I mean, the vast majority of these apply not just in a CMV, but also either a motor vehicle or just related to another crime. Well, I guess the other crimes are still related to a motor vehicle. I don't understand why we would exempt out those as counting under this provision. If the provision is good public policy, which it seems like it is, my question is why would we exempt those out from counting?
Chair Gilman, Representative Hunt, I believe what we're not exempting out those convictions. It's just that as when the Act becomes effective, that they will count towards your commercial driver's license if you're in your personal car. And until the deadline for the Act in September, if you're operating your own personal motor vehicle under a commercial driver's license, which is all-encompassing, if you have a commercial driver's license, you use that license for operation of any motor vehicle. And if you're in your own personal vehicle, it will not count before the date of this Act takes effect. After, it will count towards your commercial driver's license. It would count towards your operation of your non-commercial motorized vehicle. It just wouldn't count today towards your commercial driver's license. That's my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not exempting. We're just, that's current law.
But we would have the ability through this Act to have it apply as we do with CMVs. We would be within our realm of authority to say it applies as it does in the new version of Section 14 of the dash ones. Before, on, or after the effective date, whether it's a CMV or a motor vehicle. My basic concern is if my kid's bus driver has two DUIs today and tomorrow, I want those to count at the end of the year. I don't understand why they wouldn't.
Representative Gilman, Representative Hunt, yes, that's in the realm of your authority, I believe. We are simply have drafted a bill that would come into compliance with federal regulation and rule. That's what's before you today. But and that's why it is drawn the way it is. So.
Yes.
On another section, section 22, the dash one amends the definition of serious traffic violation and adds reckless driving in a non-CMV, which is consistent with the federal rule. But the other one, where it says adds operating a vehicle without driving privileges, is that consistent with the federal rule, or is that something in addition?
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, it's not our intent with this legislation to add anything in addition to the federal rules and law. The way we believe that this reflects federal changes, and we have not, it's not been our intent to add anything in addition to the federal rule changes.
And I appreciate that, and that, despite what my colleague pointed out, I mean, this thing should implement the federal rule. And I would prefer it not go beyond that for a number of reasons, but that's why, as I've looked, 49 CFR 38351 has four tables in it that list the different violations, whether it's in a CMV or non-CMV, and the reckless driving is in there, but I do not see operating a vehicle without driving privileges, nor do I see failure to present to a police officer in any of those four tables.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, this is one we can bring back to you at your next hearing, more specifics as far as what the federal requirements are, so we can do a cross-match for you, some of these provisions like that.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Okay.
Questions, yes?
Going back to the being grandfathered in on the driving test, mm-hmm. Why wouldn't they then, if the state Department of Ed's requirements and testing is as good as or is as comprehensive as DMV, why would they be retested on that? What is the knowledge test? Why would they have to pay for that on top of it?
It's a slightly, Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, it's a slightly different test that the federal government is requiring, and so we are in working with the Department of Education on that particular test. It's a revised test to what we've used today, but it's largely consistent with what we've done in the past. So it's our effort to try to work with the department to get those 6,500 school bus drivers who have gone through pretty extensive testing already to continue to be able to drive with just a demonstration of the knowledge test, the paper test.
Yes. And then after September 30th of this year, would they have to re-up and do it again, take another test, pay another fee? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, clarifying your question, is it for those who've just gone through the testing,
mm-hmm.
or those who missed that deadline? If they missed the deadline, they would have to take both tests. New school bus drivers would have to take that. Take both tests.
New school bus drivers would, but I mean the ones who are already tested, already in compliance, and now with this new thing, this is an additional written test, this knowledge test.
Yeah.
When September 30th hit, then what? Then
they will have that endorsement on their license, and that will continue unless some action took place to take it off.
I guess I'm curious to see what the difference is in the additional requirements by the federal to bring it up to federal standards. And the additional fee of $10 to take the bus, the knowledge test, and $21 to issue the license, is that for DMV?
Yes.
That's from DMV.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, one of the reasons we put the amounts in there today, otherwise we might have to charge the full, I think it's $70 for a commercial driver's license, and they're not getting new commercial driver licenses, they're just trying to add an endorsement to that license, so the $21 is more reflective of what our costs are to go through that process.
Further questions?
Yeah. Actually,
yes.
Just kind of a clarification based on what good questions that my colleague here was asking. Just to clarify for me, if somebody has a CDL, it expires, I mean, it has an expiration date on it, you're saying that you are retroactively and effectively moving that expiration date up unless they take this new written test? Or, I mean, is it this license that they currently have no good unless they have this other written knowledge test that you're talking about in this bill?
Chair Gilman, Representative Thatcher, this would not impact their commercial driver's license. This is simply a new endorsement that's being added to that license. So if their license was expiring, they would still have to renew their commercial driver's license. This is simply a new test and an endorsement, and the test is more specific to school bus operation than it has been in the past, and we'll get information to you on that. So they would just be required to take the new knowledge test if they already have a commercial driver's license, and then if they pass that, then the endorsement would be issued if they paid the fees.
Follow-up. So just further clarification, if this person is currently a CDL holder and is a bus driver, that license would not be valid unless they had this new endorsement on there? No?
Chair Gilman, Representative Thatcher, their license would be valid, but they would not be able to operate a school bus with children as a school bus unless they had the new endorsement. And to do that, they need to take the knowledge test before September 30th. Otherwise, after September 30th, they would have to take a drive test in a school bus and the knowledge test. Is that...
So effectively, it wouldn't be valid to drive children in school buses like they are now.
Correct.
So one day they can do it, and then one day they have to take another test in order to be able to continue to do so. Essentially.
Yes. Essentially.
That's the same boom.
So correct me if I'm wrong, then this is another federal unfunded mandate on our state. In order to, is it then? Because it sounds to me like they're talking about withholding $2 billion in highway funds, or what are they, these federal dollars?
They're highway, Chair Gilman, Representative Boone, yes is the short answer, and the funds are 5% of the highway fund, federal aid highway funds the first year, and 10% every year thereafter.
So... Basically, follow up, we basically have no choice. If we want these federal funds, we have to do what they say. And how much money is this, just, you know, ballpark? 6,500 drivers, you said. How much money are we talking about?
Chair Gilman, Representative Thatcher, I don't have the completed fiscal on this yet, but we'll get back to you on that. I believe there are between 500 and 600 bus drivers tested annually, and of that 6,500, we're not sure how many we'll capture initially, but we'll get that information to you.
Just an editorial comment, then, I guess. These are jobs that don't pay a lot of money, basically. School bus drivers don't get paid $10, $12 an hour. And to add a fee of $31 is, you know, that's, and they also don't work 8-hour days, I don't believe. So this is basically, it could be a day's work for someone to pay this fee to meet this need. Not that I'm saying it's wrong to update, you know, our school bus drivers, because we want them to be as safe as possible. What I'm hearing in this bill is there are several issues. I don't have any problem with some of the commercial driving bills cracking down on the substance abuse issue, but it doesn't sound like there's any real reason for the school bus driver piece, the knowledge, unless there's something significant in this knowledge test that they're going to be taking. And that's why I guess I'm curious, unless you guys know what it is, but you can tell us. What they're paying for, actually, to get this new endorsement that will satisfy the feds so they will release the money.
Chair Gilman, Representative Boone, I don't have an answer to that, specifically why the feds are focusing on this, but we will ask that question on your behalf.
Thank you. Thanks.
First, it's Representative Thatcher, then you.
Yes, kind of following up on what my colleague was saying. what it says in this letter from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is any state found to be in substantial noncompliance is subject to withholding of 5% of the federal aid money. Would this be considered if you just grandfathered in until, you know, not making people re-up their license that they already have? Would grandfathering something like this in put us in substantial noncompliance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, we don't believe so because of the testing that's already done, for example, by the Department of Education, which 98% of the school bus drivers in the state are through the Department of Education. They put them through a pretty rigorous behind-the-wheel test today, and that's what that certificate is intended, that they bring to us before we issue a license. It's intended to show that they have fulfilled the requirements of driving a school bus. Their requirements have been in a school bus, and the federal requirements now are must drive in a school bus. It's not any other passenger-type vehicle. I hope that answers your question.
Well, just follow up. So what you're saying is that if we didn't make them do this extra written test until it was time for them to re-up, that wouldn't put us out of compliance necessarily with the federal for the federal purposes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, we believe the written test is necessary to be done before September 30th. And that's the part I can bring back some more information for you. What we're trying to avoid is running them all through an additional behind-the-wheel test. Practically speaking, it's a bit difficult to run that many people through in that short a period of time after this bill is passed. So it's... We'll bring more information back to you as far as what's required by the federal government to be in compliance.
Okay. Representative Burley.
Well, since we went back to the school bus issue, specifically 383.123 of Chapter 49 talks about, in subpart B, talks about a substitute for driving skills test for the school bus operator.
Mm-hmm.
But it also goes on, B3 says after September 30, the provisions in that no longer apply. So that's why I was asking earlier about, you know, do we have any discretion to grandfather these bus drivers in? And the way I interpret 49.383.123 is we don't after September. That's why I'm a little bit concerned, because I'm concerned on this noncompliance too, and I just want to make sure that, you know, we're not setting ourselves up on that.
I believe, Representative Gilman and Representative Burley, if I'm understanding your question, you're concerned that after September 30th, we won't be able to grandfather them in? I think I misunderstood your question.
Well, 49 CFR 383.123 says, Part B, substitute for driving skills test. This is requirements for a school bus endorsement. And it says that B1, at the discretion of a state, the driving skills test required may be waived for an applicant who is currently licensed, has experience driving a school bus, has a good driving record, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, but then it goes on to say at B3, after September 30, 2005, the provisions in B no longer apply. So what it's telling us is after September 30, we cannot replace that. We can't waive it. Even if you have an experienced bus driver, they still have to take the tests. That's the way I read this.
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, and we won't be doing that after September 30th. This is prior to September 30th. We are grandfathering in existing school bus drivers that have a CDL and have taken the drive test 98% through the Department of Education. So this would be, you're correct, we would not be doing that after September 30th. Anyone who does not get this accomplished before September 30th would then have to take the knowledge test and the drive test in a school bus before we would issue the endorsement. So I think we're on the same page.
Okay. I think we got that.
Thank you.
Further questions,
Mr. Chairman? If I may, just one other, just and this is kind of on a tangent a little bit, but just the CDL aspect of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Rules was not the only thing that's changed in the last few years, and one specific area of interest is the hour of service rules. Are we going to have to do anything regarding compliance with that as well, or is we're okay with all that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, that's not an area of expertise that I have. That's a different part of our department, so I may have to get back to you on that one as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, yes, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of points of clarification. Am I correct that the school bus endorsement is to a CDL? In other words, okay. Then I guess my question is since you're creating this licensing mechanism for the school bus endorsement that will, in the future at least, require a behind-the-wheel test and a knowledge test, unless the individual is driving a commercial vehicle other than a school bus, why should they have both be required to have both a CDL and pay an additional amount to get a school bus?
Mr. Chair, committee staff, the CDL is a basic license. Shows a person is qualified to operate a commercial motor vehicle. The school bus endorsement is a special indicator that the person has passed special testing to operate a specific vehicle, a school bus. So it's additional, it's expected to be additional testing. It's a specialty. Like in a lot of professions, if the person wants to operate a particular type of vehicle, they need to take a specific type of knowledge test and demonstrate proficiency in that particular vehicle. That's why they require separate testing and fees to be paid.
I guess my concern is I'm assuming that there's a fairly high percentage of school bus drivers that do not drive any other kind of commercial vehicle. So why would it be necessary for them to take all of the training for a CDL if really all they want to do is demonstrate proficiency to drive a school bus?
Mr. Chair, committee staff, the simple answer, it's federal requirements. But that is what's required to demonstrate.
Required to have a CDL under
yes.
federal requirements? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bob Russell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I appear before you today in support of great portions of House Bill 2107. First, let me say I know nothing about school buses. So that is, in my view, a separate issue. The rest of the bill is dealing with my members. And these are federal regulations that were enacted by Congress back in 1999. And the states are absolutely required to adopt them. They don't have latitude. States have been totally preempted when it comes to motor carrier safety. If they don't, they will withhold the highway funds. And I don't want them to withhold any highway funds. We need those funds. So I am in support of all of the provisions of 2107 that apply to commercial drivers, Class A drivers. There's actually three different classes of CDLs, and that's perhaps part of the confusion. If you look on page 2, a Class A CDL is what my folks get under Section 3. Sub 1, that's a Class A commercial driver's license. Then there's a Class B, which is basically for a straight truck or a hoopie that we call those things. Class C gets into your bus, school bus stuff. So they're different. The statutes apply differently to the different classes of CDL. My guys all have Class A, and all the requirements we've got to do. And the only things that are brand new are the criminal background checks for the hazardous materials endorsement. And we've got to do those too. So, speaking to Representative Burley's question on the hours of service, the Motor Carrier Division does that part, and they adopt all those regulations by administrative rule, so they can adopt them very quickly, and they actually adopted them before they went into effect in January of last year. Okay. Be happy to try to answer any questions. This is a pretty complex area.
I think it's all about school buses. I think.
Okay, good.
Thanks, Bob. Kelly Sky.
Good afternoon, Chair Gilman. Members of the committee, my name is Kelly Sky, and I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we oppose House Bill 2107, understanding that it is required to come into compliance with federal law. Our organization felt that it was important to bring some issues to light, and actually Representative Boone sort of introduced one of the issues that that I wanted to bring to you, and that is, in a way, this is an unfunded mandate for you in criminal courts, because in the area of driving under the influence of intoxicants and driving while suspended and all of the other offenses that are now going to be covered when a commercial driver is driving their personal vehicle, these are cases, especially in the area of diversion, that are frequently negotiated, settled, or diverted. And these are cases that now are absolutely going to be trials. In speaking, and I will confess that I am not a practitioner who specializes in the area of driving under the influence of intoxicants. However, I have practiced trial law for 11 years. Our DUI practitioners tell me that the number one concern of people with a commercial driver's license when they come in is the driver's license suspension. And these are, you know, we're talking about people who are using their personal motor vehicle. They don't care about the jail time. It's not that they don't care, but that's not what they're concerned about when they walk into their lawyer's office. They're concerned about their driver's license because that is their livelihood. And the people that we're talking about here are oftentimes not highly educated people. They're not people who slip easily into another profession. So there is a very disparate impact in punishing the way that the federal law is requiring. And the first problem being that merely having a commercial driver's license now will make you ineligible for diversion. That, even if you're not using your commercial driver's license, this appears to make you ineligible for diversion. That's a lot more trials, and it's a lot more significant punishment for somebody who holds a commercial driver's license. Not to mention all of the new offenses that that have been added into this when you're driving your personal motor vehicle. So, as a side note, I did want to address what I believe it was Representative Hunt's concerns about exempting the prior offenses involving the use of a personal motor vehicle. And my guess, just listening and reading the bill, is that there's an ex post facto constitutional law problem there, because when a person is prosecuted for an offense, they are only eligible for the punishment that that is the law at the time. So you can't later go back and say, oh, now we're going to increase the punishment and you're going to get an extra 60 days jail, nor can we go back and say we're going to increase the punishment and take away your commercial driver's license for something that you did that was not a violation of the law in the past. So that's why I suspect that provision is written into the federal law. The second reason that we are concerned about this bill is that aside from the federal government saying that these are regulations that that need to be made law in Oregon, we really don't have any indication that our current laws are not adequate to make the roads safe for these commercial drivers. We don't have statistics here saying that a person who gets a DUI conviction driving a personal motor vehicle is more likely to drive while they're on the job. And if you think of it in terms of the number of people that are in this building today or in this room today, if they were arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants last Friday night when they went out after work, does that necessarily make them more likely to be drinking today or under the influence of intoxicants today while they're in the building working? And I submit to you that no, there is no correlation, and that we haven't been presented with what exists to be a problem. Under current law, if a person is convicted of DUI driving their personal motor vehicle, they will have their license suspended. That includes their commercial driver's license. They will be eligible for a hardship permit for work purposes only, and that means that their employer would know that they had that DUI conviction. They would be required to have an ignition interlock device in their car for a year during the suspension period, and then an additional 6 months following the suspension period. So 18 months of ignition interlock device that this commercial driver would be required to have in their car. So we believe that the current laws are adequate to cover what we're talking about. Between the disparate impact for people who have a commercial driver's license, the fiscal impact to the state of Oregon, and the increased criminal prosecution costs, and increased Department of Motor Vehicle hearings, because many of these offenses, while driven in a personal motor vehicle, or for instance the drug offenses, will require a separate finding of whether a motor vehicle was involved. Say, for instance, the person has, under the subsection that deals with controlled substances, has a conviction for delivery of a controlled substance. Someone's going to have to go back and review the records and determine whether a motor vehicle was being used at the time. So this is an additional layer of bureaucracy that we're adding. It gives you a fiscal impact. The other thing that I did want to echo Representative Burley's concerns as to failure to carry and present. The failure to carry and present law is a very broad law, and you may actually have a driver's license, but you left your wallet sitting on the counter when you walked out the door. You're guilty of failure to carry and present if the officer stops you and asks you for your license. Currently, many of those folks are eligible for dismissal of that charge when they show up in front of a judge showing that they have a driver's license. However, there are provisions in this bill that prohibit a court from hiding some of these offenses or from dismissing these offenses in an effort to have them all show up on the license or on the driving record. So that person with a commercial driver's license, even though they were fully in compliance with the law, they forgot their wallet, they now have that as a conviction on their record, whereas they wouldn't if they didn't have a commercial driver's license. And that about sums up my testimony. I'm glad to answer questions.
Thanks, Kelly. Questions? Yes.
I think that a lot of this, I appreciate your testimony from your side of the table, and that a lot of this issue is all about choices that people make. And I have to say that I come down on the side of the law on this one. I have only seen in my, I don't know how many years, 16 years now of being a firefighter, just a medical trauma team, I have never seen a car driver walk away from a crash with a truck that's head-on or rolled on him or anything like that. The driver walks away. The last log truck rollover we had on a very bad section of road, the driver was impaired, and when his family member came to pick him up, she was also impaired. And there was some exchange of something there. He gets in the car with her personal car, their car, assuming they were a couple, and he drove away in it. And so there, right there, you would have had two. There's your two. But in any case, that guy was back driving the next week, and he's probably driving today. And I guess I have a real hard time. The suspensions and getting a hardship license. I guess I understand what you were saying about someone's livelihood and all that, but they need to think about that before they get inside this bomb on the road and take off impaired. And if they're impaired for fun or for staying awake or for whatever their reason is, it's really not fair to the rest of us out on the road who try to make responsible choices when we get in our cars. Because I think I heard somewhere along the line in my life when I was a kid, getting ready to drive, 1 in 10 drivers coming out, and I'm 53 years old, so when I started driving at 16, I heard this, 1 in 10 drivers coming at you on the road is impaired in some way, and I'm wondering what that statistic is now, if that's still true. And if that is true, and it's only 1 in 10, that's a lot right there. And if those people continue to, they get suspended, how many times, I don't know if any of you have any issue with people who are out there driving and suspended and all that. they can be suspended, and they're still driving, they're uninsured, they're suspended, they get hit again, they're suspended. We do not do enough to get these drivers off the road. In any other country, they would not even have, they'd get one chance. They would never drive again. They would lose their car. We do have the impound tape, you know, but we don't do enough right now. And I just can't feel sorry for someone for making a bad choice and then getting a free ride the next week on a hardship license and free to go and impair themselves in their own vehicle on the weekends and go back to work on Monday in a truck. So I'm sorry for expounding there. That's what I think.
Further comments? Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
Brent West.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brett West. I'm Assistant Superintendent for Finance Administration at the Department of Education, and we wanted to come up today and let you know that we do support the amendments in the bill. They do bring us in compliance with federal law, and based on some of the earlier questioning this a little earlier, we want to be clear that there's currently not a written test that's required for a bus driver. We do behind-the-wheel testing for bus drivers, so this federal requirement does add a new test to what bus drivers need to do to get their certification. The expert on all bus driving matters is Craig Pruitt beside me here, so if you have any real technical questions, he's the man to speak to.
Questions? I guess not, but I'm amazed. let's go through what the impact's going to be on a typical school bus driver.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Craig Pruitt. I'm a consultant for Oregon Department of Education in the pupil transportation industry. As far as what it takes for a new driver to get behind the wheel and operate a school bus.
I'm thinking of a driver now.
Driver now.
So after we pass this law, what's going to be the effect on that driver?
What's going to be the effect? The effect is they're going to have to take a written test the way this language reads. The written test will be approximately, I believe the P is $10 for that written test. And then they'll need to have their commercial driver's license reissued with the endorsement on the commercial driver's license. And as I've kind of listened to some of the questions, one of the key elements here is the endorsement has to be on the driver's license. It can't simply be in a database somewhere. A police officer who would have a question needs to have the ability to look at the license and see if that operator is entitled to operate that vehicle. This legislation, as it's put together, does not materially change the way school bus drivers function in this state as far as receiving their school bus driver certificate, other than we will have some more additional things to look for before our department issues a certificate to anyone who would operate a school bus.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that
question. Oh, well, I just wondered if he was familiar with what the content of the written test would be.
The content?
Yeah.
I believe we have a link on our webpage. Oregon Department of Education, pupil transportation, there's a link there that takes you to a, how can I word this? It's an excerpt that's going into the commercial driver's license manual, and I believe it's somewhere between 15 and 20 pages long. And it simply identifies what the requirements are, what a bus driver is supposed to be doing in this state, how to load students, how to deal with railroad crossings, how to deal with passenger issues, and it's strictly school bus related.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, we could send that link to your committee administrator if that would make it easier for you to disseminate the information.
Yes, Representative Barnes.
In your history of, and there isn't a lot of history on this, but the fees that are charged for these, are most of them paid for by the applicant, or does the district pick up some of these fees at this point and maybe in the future?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I actually didn't know the answer to that until I saw some of the materials handed out to you, and we saw that some districts do cover the cost of these. It would be most likely an issue that would be bargained locally, and the Department of Education wouldn't be involved in that.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a view on the issue of whether or not infractions prior to enactment of this legislation should be counted toward the limit under Section 13?
Nice? Representative Hunt, Chairman and Committee. The infractions identified in this bill, some of those infractions we as a department do not have the ability to look at because they are masked under a diversion program. There have been situations where we have had operators who have had one or more of the serious traffic violations on their record, and they have been masked through a diversion program. Depending on the district, some operators, when they go to court and determination is made, the district will terminate their employment, in which case we simply make their school bus driver certificate inactive. But if it's a diversion program and the district wishes to monitor that and they go through the process, the operator is still allowed to continue to transport.
If I could follow up. So as a matter of public policy, do you think it makes sense to say, assuming it's not a commercial motor vehicle infraction, that it's just a motor vehicle infraction, do you think it makes sense to say, clean slate starting now, only infractions going forward after enactment of this legislation? Or is, 'cause I realize it's not required under what the federal government is telling us we have to do. What's your sense as a matter of public policy, if it makes sense to just look prospectively forward, or if it makes sense to look retroactively as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, we haven't actually had a discussion about that prior to being here today, so on the face of it, it would seem to make sense, but I would hate to set public policy on the spur of the moment like this.
Further questions? Thank you.
Well, actually, I just wanted to say when we get a chance, I have a follow-up question for regarding DMV fees.
Okay.
If we could follow up later.
Goodbye. Tricia Smith.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, which is about 20,000 education professionals working in K-12 districts, ESDs, Head Starts, community colleges, including school bus drivers. And I'm here to offer grudging support to House Bill 2107. My understanding is the federal government has decided that we will do this, and so we must. However, I appreciate the committee's questions and concerns about these additional requirements on our school bus drivers. Frankly, I think there are a lot of professionals that don't get tested as often as my school bus drivers do, and one more test and one more fee is one more test and one more fee for people that are doing the job today. And it's unfortunate that they're going to have to go through this, and I appreciate the committee's questions about whether or not there is a way to waive as much as possible for existing professionals, and I hope that you will continue to look for those ways to help them. As you can see from the handouts from the Department of Motor Vehicles, the cost of becoming a school bus driver is pretty high, especially when you think about the part-time aspect of the job, the low wages of the job, and the difficulties in what are you going to do in the summer with no unemployment. So the more these kinds of requirements we put on school bus drivers, the more difficult it is for schools to find school bus drivers. I don't know the answer, Representative Beyer, to your question about how many districts pay for these kinds of fees. I would anticipate these new fees will not be borne by school districts because they're not, unless they happen to be settling contracts right now, and they happen to think about putting these fees in them. They're new. So I expect my drivers will probably spend the money to pay the fees, to take the test, to prove what everybody knows, and that is that they're good school bus drivers. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Ma'am.
I appreciate raising the very legitimate concern in terms of the fact that the vast majority of bus drivers totally are good actors, do a good job. Obviously, so much of the legislation we write is trying to focus on, you know, if we're writing campaign ethics rules, it's trying to focus on the very rare exception where that's being violated. It seems like a similar example here. I guess I'd be interested in your take on the same question I just asked the previous panel in terms of looking at the public policy matter. Do you think it makes sense to apply these standards only with a clean slate starting today, or to also say if these standards are good public policy, they should apply retroactively?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, if I understand your question in, from listening in the back, and honestly, when you were talking to the others about the CDLs, I was only partly listening. My understanding is, the question is, should the new provisions in the CDL law that allow violations of DUII in a private vehicle to affect the commercial driver's license, should that new requirement be allowed to be in effect retroactively? That is, a long time ago, the bus driver got a DUI in his private vehicle. This new law passes. Should that be grounds for revoking his CDL? In listening to the others' responses, I think my first question would be about the response from the representative of the criminal defense attorneys, who indicated that that would not be constitutional, that you can't retroactively apply penalties to violations of the law. The violations of the law receive the penalties that are in existence at the time of the violation. So I wouldn't think in that respect it would be good public policy. I will tell you that for my school bus drivers, school districts are very concerned about making sure that the people that have control over 70 kids in a school bus know what they're doing and that they're very professional drivers. They take drug tests very often. They are trained very carefully. And so I think that for my folks, if there is an issue of a DUI, if there has been an issue of a DUI or a driver who has a problem with drinking and driving, I would expect that the school district is handling that as soon as they hear it, because of the liability that they face with those children in the buses.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else to testify on 2107? Okay, you had a question for Robin again, did you?
I did.
Yeah, Robin, you and Tom, come back up, please. Is there any better?
Yeah, you're not off the hook yet. I'm just wondering if, for purposes of the particular situation we're talking about, that we're concerned about, with the written exam for people who already hold a license, could there possibly be a different type of fee structure? They've already got their license. Can you get like a sticker or something and make a special low fee for that type of, you know, transitional type of endorsement? Is that something to think about? Rather than reissuing a $21 license that they already have, you know, I could see the testing fee, but then another fee on top of it to get another license that they already have.
Chair Gilman, Representative Thatcher, I don't think we can answer that today. I'll take that back to DMV, and again, I think that's out of Tom's area of expertise, but we will look into that. I did want to point out, since you called me back up, there is a two-page question follow-up that we did have some initial conversations with the chairman and the co-chairs, and on the second page, under number 6, it does talk about, give you some more information on what we issue, why we issue it, and the fees, but we will look into the fee structure on this and get back to you, if that's all right.
Now, any other questions that maybe should be presented. Obviously, we're not working this bill today, and I want the committee well informed on it before we move it out. So if you have more questions to the department, anything you think of would be a good time now to let them know. Yes.
Well, then I would like to make a suggestion based on what Representative Thatcher brought up. If it is just to check off, rubber stamp, whatever you want to call it, the fact that the person has taken this new test rather than a $21 fee, could there somehow be some way to issue something? I mean, it's all done electronically, too, I imagine. I guess we're wondering why it would cost $21 to issue the license or the endorsement.
Chair Gilman, Representative Boone, I understand your question, and I need to go back and talk with DMV and the actual people that issue the driver's license, but I think the endorsements are... They are actually embedded in our driver's licenses, and there's reasons for that. So we would have to actually, I'm sure, reissue. But I want to ask more questions on my behalf and yours, and I'll get back to you on that.
Okay.
And I do think that the endorsement fee is consistent with our other endorsement fees that we issue. So I don't think it's we certainly haven't padded this cost. But I'll get more information on the fee structure for you. Thank you.
No further questions. I close the hearing on 2107. And open the hearing on 2116. John, quickly.
Yes. Very briefly, yep. Mr. Chair, this bill allows the Department of Transportation to establish a process for establishing and designating speeds on highways by rule. The bill would become effective on passage. Essentially, the background is that ODOT currently has to list each separate speed zone designation for each segment of highway individually in its rules. The bill would allow the department to establish a process for setting speed designations by rule, but would not be required to list the individual designations.
And John Joshley. We're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Jackley, Executive Officer for the Highway Division. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this afternoon. This bill, House Bill 2116, establishes designated speeds on highways other than interstates by administrative rule. It would allow us to have one administrative rule, and then specific speeds would be set by what's called speed zone orders, which are the result of a public process. This bill would correct an unintended consequence from a previous bill last session, and House Bill 2116 reestablishes this process to designate speed zones, but a couple of important things. It doesn't set any particular speed anywhere. It also doesn't affect the interstates, and it really doesn't have anything to do with school zones. I thought I'd point that out at the start. The background is this. House Bill 2661 last session clarified all kinds of speed bills, and it made a whole bunch of bills and speed laws easier for drivers, courts, and law enforcement to understand. It also provided for an increase in overall speeds on the interstate if the Oregon Transportation Commission approved. They didn't do it. But if they had done it, it would have been done by rule, and we think that part ought to be retained. But after the session, we received an informal opinion from our Attorney General that said the language of House Bill 2661 inadvertently meant that all speed zone changes had to be adopted by separate administrative rule. Now, that was never our intent, and that's why we're offering 2116 to correct it. Each year, we have about 100 to 120 speed zone changes each year on non-interstate highways. Without this bill, it would mean having to adopt a separate rule every time a local community wanted to change a speed zone for safety or for any other reason. Now, a speed zone change normally takes 3 months, 3 months to a year to complete, depending on the complexity of the situation. If we had to do a separate rule for each change, that would add 6 months, add an enormous amount of time, paperwork, and an added bureaucratic process that we never intended and don't need and don't want. Instead, we respectfully request your support for House Bill 2116, which would allow us to have the single rule for the non-interstate highways with changes made by speed zone order under that rule. That's the way it's been all along. We'd like to go back to the way it used to be, and we think that it offers the most responsive, most flexible option for local communities to change these speed zones when safety or other reasons require it. Thank you.
John, this is the way you've been doing it prior to passage of 2661, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. This is the way it's always been. It was just an unintended oversight. We didn't catch it. We never intended to have a separate rule for each speed zone all over the state. And this bill would allow us just to go back to the way it's always been.
Okay. Questions? Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Anyone else testify on 2116? I'll close the hearing and open a work session on 2116.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2116 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thatcher moves 2116 to the House to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Mike, call the roll, please.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Yes.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Broome?
Aye.
Representative Broome?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Excused.
Chair Gilman?
Aye. Oh. Chair will entertain a motion to suspend the rules and allow Representative Burley to vote on 2116.
So moved.
Any objection? So ordered. Do you want to vote on this?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And consent calendar, Representative Byer, or...
I think it should probably be fine.
Yeah.
We'll find out. I move that we place 2116 on the consent calendar.
Mm-hmm. Representative Byer moves we place 2116 on the consent calendar. Discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. Okay, now we have a few city bills we'd like to introduce. Yes, John, do you want to kind of run through them?
Do you want me to do all of them at once?
I think so, because I think I can take a motion for all of them at once.
Mr. Chair, we have four bills that have been brought to our attention for possible introduction as committee bills. The first is LC 1849. It's defined as the Safe Routes to Schools Act. It was brought to us by the Willamette Pedestrian Alliance. It establishes a Safe Routes to Schools Fund. It authorizes ZODOT to apply for, accept, or receive funds, which would be placed in the Safe Routes to School Fund. Fund could be used to finance grants, technical services, and advice, public information, and education, or evaluate community programs related to developing safe walking and bicycling routes to schools. If you have any questions about the bill before we act on it, Scott Bricker, who brought the bill to our attention, is here today. The second bill is LC 2591. Is brought to us by Jim Gardner, representing Hertz Rent-A-Car. It would allow rental or leasing companies to register a vehicle for an annual or biennial period, and it would add a $1 per vehicle fee that would be paid by any company wishing to have this option available to them. The next bill is LC 2846. It's a bill that was introduced or brought to our attention by ODOT. It essentially would allow vehicle owners to transfer specific plates to another vehicle without purchasing a custom registration to do so. It restores language allowing transfer of Oregon Trail license plates that was removed by Senate Bill 508 in the 2003 session, and it would also allow transfers other kinds of specialty plates without reverting to custom registration if in the future any of them are discontinued. The last bill is a bill that was brought to our attention by Sean Miller of the Independent Auto Dealers Association, and it deals with motor vehicle brokers and the types of fees they can accept. My understanding from talking with Mr. Miller is that at this point this draft is largely a vehicle and that there are a number of interested parties that are working on potential amendments to it. So those are the four bills that we have before us.
Thank you. Do I have a motion to submit these as committee bills?
So moved.
Thank you. Any discussion?
Well, I do have some concerns. I will vote yes to move this as a committee bill, but I did have concerns on the Safe Routes to School Fund because I'm concerned that we get, as a legislature, wrapped up in promoting more and more programs that sound good but seem to perpetuate more symbolism over real substance, and that's where I kind of have a hang up on it.
Thank you. Anything further? All right. We have a motion, and if I have no further objections, I'm going to accept these four bills as committee bills. Anything else, John, to come to? I thought sure we were going to miss the 3 o'clock deadline 15 minutes ago. Oh, yes. And we have...
Mr. Chair, we have one other bill for possible committee consideration, but it's the Chair's belief that you would probably want to look at this bill before we consider it. I will need to check and see whether we can consider it on Wednesday because we did not put consideration of committee bills on our agenda. So we may have to wait until next Monday to do it, which is the final day that we can file a committee bill. But if you'd like, I will pass this out, and then you can all have a look at it, and we will either do it on Wednesday or Monday, depending on advice we receive from the chief clerk's office as to whether we can do it or not.
And please come talk to me a little bit. I'd like to have some notion from the committee how you feel about this before we jump on it.
Who brought this?
In memory of Representative Randy Miller.
The memory of. It's a ghost.
All right. Anything further? The meeting's adjourned.